Hello, welcome back to My First Panic Attack with Josh Gunston. And this episode features Amber Kennedy, who is one of my friends from school. We go quite far back now. We haven't spoken in a while, but we still chat on socials quite a bit. This particular episode focuses on her journey through working in the dance industry and sort of dance and drama. So she works for like pantomimes and doing shows, and that's the sort of context that you need going into this episode, just so you're kind of aware about what she does as a job. And the sort of problems that arise in her particular industry, but also her own struggles with social anxiety and also my own struggles with social anxiety. So that is brought up a couple of times as well. And also just kind of talking about growing up, being mixed race, living in the UK, experiencing racism, you know, experiencing racism and not being able to turn to the right people for support. There's a lot to cover in this episode. It is a long one. It's a big one. So listen at your own risk, essentially. Got so many other cool stuff to show you guys soon, so very excited to get the ball rolling, but for now I'll leave you with this one. Hope you enjoy it, and yeah, let me know what you think. Cool, bye. I haven't actually spoken to you in about, it's a bit strange, isn't it?
Yeah.
I haven't really spoken to you in about, I don't know, face-to-face, like 5 years? Longer.
Yeah, maybe longer.
I don't think I've seen you out in a while.
Well, I've not been around, that's the thing. Yeah. Like, I've not been solidly living in Brighton. This is the longest I've been in Brighton in maybe 3 years.
Where were you before, again?
So, I basically just lived on tour.
Yeah.
So, I was like, at my mum and dad's in Hove, and then they moved over to Shoreham, and I went with them. And then I moved back to Hove when I was still with Sid.
Okay.
We lived...
Who's your ex-boyfriend?
Yeah.
Just for clarity.
Yeah. And we were there then on the seafront in Hove.
Whereabouts?
Roman Road, right opposite the lagoon. Yeah,
yeah, so nice.
Brand new build, so it was like, flat was absolutely stunning.
I know the ones you're talking about. Yeah. And I live the road up from there.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
mad.
I know. This whole time.
It's so mad. The whole time you've been like probably a stone's throw away.
Yeah, literally. I live like up from Wish Park.
Oh, cool.
So it's not far from, that's my family house.
Yeah.
Not far from where you were.
Yeah.
That's pretty crazy. It's a nice area to live.
Yeah.
So you were there.
And then I went to Windsor for a little bit.
Right,
because
okay.
I was in Panto. So I was there for a couple of months.
Okay.
Then I came back down, and the day I finished Panto, I started a tour with the Best of Wham.
Okay, cool.
I did that for 8 months up and down the country, like sporadically in Brighton, but not really. And yeah. then after that finished, I went back to Windsor again to do another Panto season there.
Cool.
And then when that finished, I was back in Brighton for, I think it was 2 weeks before I had my Joseph audition. I auditioned for Joseph on the Monday morning, and on the Monday night I had the offer.
Nice.
And the next Monday I was in London starting rehearsals.
Wow.
And then I've toured with that until 6 months ago.
So you were living in London?
I was living in London, yes and no, because I was essentially based in my car, really.
Yeah.
So like my address on like all my bank details and everything like that was my Brighton address.
Okay.
But I wasn't in Brighton.
Yeah.
Like I was on tour, so
yeah.
I stayed in London whilst we rehearsed. We rehearsed for 2 weeks, and then from there we went back to Windsor. So
right,
I was
okay.
back to a place
wow.
that
okay.
I knew.
Yeah.
And then I was in Windsor for 2 weeks, and then from there went up and down the country: Edinburgh, Dublin, Crawley.
Wow.
Mental places, yeah, and like Newcastle, Liverpool, all over the place, really.
That's mad. I think it does. Like, did you like doing that, or
yeah, definitely.
So you enjoyed it,
yeah, definitely.
Because some people don't like it. Some people have the whole home bird mentality where it's like moving around too much is quite difficult. But I mean, some people like embrace that. So it's kind of nice that you enjoyed that, because some people really struggle. Some people thrive off it. It's like moving around a lot, you know?
Yeah. And I thought I was going to be one of those people that really struggled.
Yeah.
Like when I first got my first job, when I went to Panto, I was still with Sid, my ex, and I didn't want to leave at
yeah.
all. Like I knew that performing was what I wanted to do, but I didn't want to leave, and he was having to convince me to get in the car and drive up to Windsor
right,
and
okay.
go and do it. Like, because
yeah.
I was like, what if, you know,
what if,
yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm like, a lot of people would probably disagree with this, but I am actually a very shy person.
Okay.
And people find that hard to comprehend because I perform. Mm. They expect someone who performs to be confident all the time. And I am actually very shy in social situations. And okay. So I was so worried about walking into a room where I knew no one.
I feel you.
And that was what, like, that was the main thing. I was like, to Sid, what if I don't like anyone?
Mm.
What if no one likes me? What if I can't do the job? What if I'm not good enough? What if?
Yeah.
And I was so scared because for a long time we were together. By the time we broke up, it was 5 years that we were together. Mm. And he'd been my friend for a long time before that. So I'd got very used to him being my crutch. And he brought out a lot of good things in me because he would make me do things, not in a nasty way or anything like that. But when I first met Sid, I wouldn't go up to the bar by myself. I wouldn't like walk into a shop on my own or anything like that because I was that anxious about doing those kind of things. If we ever went out, like, I would happily give him my money to go and buy the drinks, but I couldn't do that myself. I couldn't go up and speak to the barman. And recently I had a conversation with my mum and I found out that she's exactly the same.
Wow.
And I never knew that, like, in my 26 years. And I've always been like it. And when before I met Sid, I had my little sister who used to do the same thing.
Right.
So, like, if we would go, if mum would be like, can you go down the shop and get some milk? I'd go with my sister, Jade, and she would do the transaction because I couldn't speak to the person in the shop. Like, and it's always, for as long as I can remember, it's always been like that my whole life. I've had this fear of speaking to strangers.
Yeah.
I think that's essentially what it is. But it does sometimes extend into like groups of people and stuff like that. I remember once going to a house party that you probably were at and like being outside and sweating, like sweating so bad because I didn't want to walk in. And I don't know if you remember, but there was a time when like I was sort of like the only one of the girls, like my group of girls that was friends with like your group of boys.
Yeah, I remember.
So like I didn't have them a lot of the time because they would be doing other things. So like sometimes we'd turn up at a friend's house and I would be going on my own.
Yeah.
And it was all of you guys and I knew you all.
Yeah.
But I would still be like terrified to like walk in.
Yeah, it's that social anxiety, innit?
Yeah,
it just like plagues us all the time. And I think it's actually more common than you think as well. I think so many people like brush it off.
Or definitely.
If you put like people in a room right now, I think it'd be like one in four people, one in three people would be like, yeah, I have the same issue. Whether it's going to a shop, I've got friends who like walk into a supermarket and start like panicking in the queue, and they're like, oh my god, everyone's looking at me.
Yeah,
danger.
Yep.
Or people that just can't. I've actually been there myself where I need to do something and it's such a scary step that I literally just freeze.
Yeah.
I'm like, right, I can't do this. And I have to like sit there and try and plan about like how I'm going to do it, whether it's going into a house. I went to, sorry, off topic, but on topic, I went to a party in London. So my friend Steph, she was like, come to this party. And I just moved to London. I was there for like 3 months at this point. And she was like, yeah, come through. It'll be fun. There's loads of people here. I was like, all right, cool. I lived in Brixton, so it was going from Brixton to like East to Greenwich, so it was quite a journey. And I got there, and it was dark, and it was late through these like back streets. And then I found the house, and she wasn't answering the phone. I was like, please no! I could hear so many people in there, like people were shouting, and I was like, oh fuck, I can't go in. I'm so scared. So I stood outside for like 5 minutes trying to like prepare myself. But actually, easier said than done. But when you just do something, it's that comfort zone
in.
Theory again, like you just do it. I knocked on the door, they opened the door like, oh, who are you here for? I was like, oh, Steph. And she was like, oh, she's out the back somewhere. So I walked through this whole house, get to this garden, and there was so many people there, but then she was there. And I think really like when you just jump in and like face it, it is the way to do it, but it's so hard to do that.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think like there's just I kind of get you on the social anxiety. And it's interesting what you said as well about your ex, because most of the time, not all the time, to be fair, I'm not going to generalize, but a lot of people go into relationships and the opposite happens, where like they start off being quite confident and then sometimes these relationships can be toxic, and it kind of like it's the reverse, so like they start to not be able to do anything on their own.
Yeah,
so it's kind of interesting that you're saying that, like,
oh no, I owe him so much.
That's mad. That's amazing.
So much, because he wouldn't take no for an answer, and not in a harsh way at all, like in a supportive way. He would be like, look mate, you've got to do this.
Yeah, yeah.
You've got to go up and talk to that person.
Yeah.
Because what happens when you have to go up and talk to that person and I'm not here to do it for you?
Yeah, it's true though. It's very true.
You have to do it. Like, you've got to start like traveling on your own and doing things on your own. And you know, and I think it was so subconscious that I always had people to do these things for me.
Right.
Like, I don't think I necessarily knew until he highlighted how much I was getting people to do things for me. Like, and then when I went on tour, because there was like a lack of Sid's presence, I started reverting back to doing it again.
Okay.
And because there was a group of people, I got away with it for a long time because I could hand one person my card and send them up to the bar to get drinks. And then I could do it with the person sat next to them the next time,
right.
You know, and people weren't realizing that I'd managed to stay sat in my seat for the whole evening and not had to go and interact with someone that I hadn't interacted with ever before.
Did you, what goes through your body or your mind physically and mentally when you, if it's like, well, maybe not now, but before, when it's like, oh, you need to go to the bar and get me a drink. Like, what happens to you?
I just get like...
If you don't mind me asking.
Yeah, it freaks me out. Like, I get worried that I'm going to say the wrong thing, that I'm going to order the wrong thing. Maybe my card will get declined. Like, I think I'm scared of embarrassment.
I was going to say, it's like the fear of like being ridiculed or embarrassed, right?
Or like, what if they say something and I mishear them and then like...
Awkward.
You know, it's embarrassment, it's awkwardness, it's uncomfortableness. Like, what if they say something to me, you know, they start like joking with me and I interpret it the wrong way. You know, what if someone says the wrong thing? What if I say the wrong thing? It's just ifs.
Okay.
Like,
I'm with you. So do you, would you panic or would you just more be like, oh, I don't want to do this? Like, is it like quite an extreme feeling or was it more like
varies. Like, it completely varies. Sometimes it would not be as extreme because I think if I know in the back of my mind that I can go and sit down with a group of friends that are going to laugh off any awkwardness or anything like that.
Okay. So comfortability.
Like if I'm comfortable everywhere except for at the bar, you know, it's a lot of the time I feel once I've done it once or twice in a place, then it's kind of okay. Like, even if I don't know the person behind the bar
I'm fully with like, you. It's a comfort zone.
Yeah, definitely. It is a comfort zone. And like that, yeah, so that would be fine. But sometimes it is quite extreme. Sometimes, like, I would point blank refuse to do it. Like, there's been times when I have been going to meet someone and I've been sat there and I've, like, refused to get a drink or something to eat or something like that because I don't want to go up and face this person that I don't know.
Wow, that's so interesting, like, hearing you say that. I don't know, it's just fascinating.
Yeah.
Like, because I don't really look into social anxiety too much. I went through it a little bit, but never on this kind of level. There's so many layers. Do you know what I mean? Everyone's got their own niche of like social anxiety, but what you're describing is it's very niche. Like, but it's not at the same time because it does apply to so many things in life, like just speaking to strangers. But now, what's it like now?
Yeah, I'd say now it is better. It still, like, I'm still in a place where sometimes I don't like to walk into somewhere I've never been before unless I know someone I know is in there and stuff like that. Like, if I'm meeting someone at the pub, I'll like sometimes turn up a little bit late so I know that they're going to be there and stuff like that. Like, it, and I don't necessarily like to go places on my own.
Okay.
How
do you feel about coming here today?
Yeah, I felt...
Do you freak out a bit?
Yeah, I felt nervous about coming here today.
You got a bus as well, so was that quite like... Were you just sitting there like,
that was
fuck.
Weird.
Yeah,
I took my book and made sure I was like, going to be like distracted the whole time.
Nice.
I'm reading Harry Potter.
Okay,
Harry
good,
Potter
you've got to do
is,
it that's what I do sometimes.
It is something that I come back to when everything around me is changing, because it's something that I know will
it's
always
familiar.
Be the same.
Yeah,
yeah, so...
You're giving me so many clues to like how your mind works right now. It's like familiarity and then like the comfort zone. And I kind of see it with Harry Potter. And I do the same thing. If I want to feel that comfort, that sense of like childhood nostalgia and like sense of peace, because I know what's coming, I'm like, oh, it's fine. I can just read this book because I know what's coming. It's safe. I feel happy with it.
Yeah.
I think like some people have the same thing where like I've got friends who can't watch films. I've got a friend who literally, if she knows like someone's going to die in a film, like she just won't watch it. Like she'll be like, oh, I don't want to watch that. It's like traumatic. It's like, because it's not comfortable. It's not familiar. And I think that's like, it's an extension of social anxiety still. Like there's so many layers to it. It's actually crazy. But I get you on Harry Potter.
Yeah.
I literally do the same thing.
And I don't really like it because I don't really like to pay J.K. Rowling's bills
I feel
that's
you.
Going on at the moment.
Yeah,
but
okay, I'm with you.
It's, you know, I try and keep that separate in my mind when I'm doing it because
it's
just,
for the right, I understand, but you know, there's a understanding as to why you're doing it, and I get it. You're not here to like be like supporting that particular author, it's more like that book has given you like a sense of comfort in your
life.
Yeah,
definitely. And it's just, I've been reading the series actually now. I first started it when I started going through something on tour.
Okay.
And it's taken me a while to get through it, which it really? Never normally does, to be honest with you. Like, I can normally pick one up and get through it, like the shorter ones in like a couple of days and stuff like that. Okay. Because as soon as I'm immersed in that familiarity,
can't stop.
That's it.
It's like a TV show for me, though.
Yeah.
It's like when I start watching something after like the first two episodes, I'm like, I can't stop watching this now.
Yeah.
It's mad. Yeah. Like, that immersion is so true. And I think that's what I've realized, that I perform best in life when I'm immersed in something on the side.
Mm-hmm.
So like, life's really good if in the evenings I'm watching a TV show,
yeah,
like, and I've got into something new or a book, because suddenly everything in my life doesn't really matter. It's like, okay, it's fine, but if I'm on my own later, I can just watch this show. I'm so excited to get home, get mm-hmm. in bed and watch it. Mm-hmm. Whereas when I haven't got that immersion, I'm just always in the present, which is good and bad, but I do struggle. So I kind of get you in that one as well.
Yeah.
It's really interesting when you say that, though. Like, it is fascinating. And I think, like, we do need distractions to get through stuff in life. Definitely now.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
Like, this is a hard time to, like, sit with your thoughts. Like, it's a skill if you can do it, but it is really difficult.
Yeah, I admire people that can do stuff like that.
Does it? But the thing is, though, like, I think, really, it's funny because I think everyone has the ability to do it. It just takes so much practice.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, you could easily do it. I could easily do it. But it's not easy. It's as much as it is easy to do, in theory, it's a big hurdle. And I think being on your, like, are you okay on your own? Like, when you just sit, like, at home, do anything?
Yeah, I am, which is weird, I think. Because, like, I obviously have, you know, a lot of, like, fears about a lot of different things, but weirdly I'm all right on my own.
Right.
I think initially I suffered a lot of separation anxiety from Sid when we were together, because he was there all the time. And that wasn't, you know, that was completely through choice. We first met each other and we were like best friends almost within an instant. Mm. And like, then we were just always out together, like, and we lived within like less than 5 minutes walk away from one another. So like, we were always together. And then as soon as it became romantic, it just went to the next level. Like, if he wasn't at my house, I was at his, and we just like lived in each other's pockets. And neither of us wanted to not do that. Like, we wanted to be together all the time. So like, the idea of being without him was like so scary, even if it was just like when we first got together, he didn't have a full-time 9-to-5 job.
Right.
We both worked quite similarly. We worked quite sporadically.
Mm-hmm.
He was coaching sports and I was teaching dance. So we were working at similar times a lot of the time, sort of like after school clubs or before school clubs, that kind of thing. And it was like an hour here and there. And then we had like the rest of the day to be together or do whatever. And then when he first got his first 9-to-5, like, I was like, what am I going to do all day? What am I supposed to do when you're off, like, distracted by this whole other thing? And,
yeah, I see.
And stuff like that. And then, like, that obviously got bigger when I got my first professional job and I was going off to Panto, because we were living together at that point. And I was worried that what was I going to do? Like, I couldn't finish a day at work and then come home and see Sid. Like, my familiarity, it wasn't going to be there. So, like, that was definitely, like, really scary. But then, like, I found once I did it and once I got over that hurdle, like, I actually really enjoyed it. And that's what I mean when I say I never thought I was going to be a person that was going to enjoy touring.
Yeah.
But now I'm like, that's literally what I want to do for the next few years until I have a motive to settle. That's like what I want to
do. That's cool. That's good, though. That's a great goal. That's a great thing to have in mind as well. Like, it's a good thing to work towards. I kind of get that. And I think really, like, at least you have an understanding of what you want from life. Not everyone does. You know, I know it's like a weird time to actually make plans, but at least you kind of understand that. And you do seem stronger because of the way you're talking about all this stuff as well. You can definitely hear in your voice that you've kind of grown a lot since, I guess, that relationship to now.
Yeah.
So how long have you not been together for?
It's coming up to 2 years now.
Right, okay.
We're still very present in each other's lives.
Right.
And we have maintained like a really strong level of friendship.
It's amazing.
Throughout.
That's like very rare as well.
Yeah,
so
very,
nice.
Very rare. And like, I feel very lucky to have him, especially as I feel like I owe him so much.
Yeah.
You know, I'd hope that he would say the same about me.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
like, well, I think we're very lucky that we've both given each other like so much. You know, he's given me so much strength. And I think in turn, he's inherited a little bit of my weaknesses, which is good for him, okay. if you know what I mean. Like, you know, he would always be a person that would dive straight into stuff. And right. sometimes that could lead him into some sticky situations, you know. Yeah. He would do things without thinking. He was quite reckless and spontaneous yeah. and stuff. And, like, living with me sort of...
Routine-based.
Yeah. Different. Like, yeah, like... I don't know. I think I gave him a lot of maturity that, like, he maybe lacked, but not even like a necessarily like a mental maturity. It was more of like a lifestyle maturity.
Okay.
You know, when I first met him, he didn't know how to work a washing machine, which for me seemed bizarre because right. I've had a level of independence since I was
young. Since a young age, yeah. I remember.
That, like, that, you know, is maybe it is rare. Like, my mum had two kids when I was 13. My younger brother Charlie was born, and then a year and a half later Caden was born. Mm. So there were babies in the house from when I was 13, and my mum had various issues after the boys were born, and she's also an NHS nurse, so she went back to work quite quickly yeah. after the boys were born as well. So my sister and I picked up a lot of the childcare.
Yeah.
So we were adults when we were kids, like, if you I don't know.
No, I get you. No, you had responsibility.
Yeah, we had responsibility. Yeah. And it wasn't unwanted responsibility no, at all. Like, we loved it. Like, yeah. we loved, like, I could not imagine my life without my brothers now. Yeah. And it's crazy because now Charlie is 13 and I'm 26. We're at a point where for exactly half my life I've had him and exactly half my life I haven't, which is so weird because I honestly can't remember what it was like when it was just the three of us, because I've got four siblings. So there's five of us. Got big brother, then there's me, then there's my little sister, and then my two little brothers.
Got big brother?
Yeah. Yeah. So he's London based, and he's 30. He's from my dad's first marriage. He's not my full brother, but I've always considered
him your dad.
A full brother.
Dad used to scare me back in the day. He was a good man. Oh my God. Sorry. Just thinking back to when I was a child now. But no, that's, I think it's kind of, you've got a big family now. It's kind of nice to look back, and you've got, you're kind of in the middle. You're kind of, well, sort of, you're sort of like top end middle.
Yeah, it is weird because as far as my mum's concerned, I'm her first kid. Yeah, so I'm the oldest. Yeah. But because of my big brother, like, I'm not the oldest, but I am the oldest.
Yeah, yeah, no, I'm fully with you, yeah.
And I think, he was with his mum for a lot of our childhood. So, like, in terms of the household, I was the oldest kid until weekends when my brother would come stay with us.
Okay, yeah.
And then I'd get to be, little sister again. And then, you know, and when the boys were born, I was, like, picking up a lot of responsibilities. I would be at school and then go to nursery and pick them up, take them home, do the dinner and stuff like that. All while, you know, juggling...
School
and
GCSEs.
All my things that I wanted to do as well, because I've danced ever since I was out of nappies. So I was going to dance 5-6 times a week and doing all these things. And, like, you know, it's not like I raised the kids single-handedly or anything like that. It's just like, for a 13-year-old, it was responsibilities that other 13-year-olds that I went to school with
I didn't have that.
You know, so, like, for me, when I met someone who didn't know how to do those things, I took it for granted that I learnt those things young.
Yeah.
Because I was like, what do you mean? What do you mean your mum still does your washing for you?
Yeah.
What do you mean you don't know how to load the dishwasher? Like, yeah. What are you talking about?
I mean, I'm kind of the same as you in a sense of, I had to do a lot of things as a kid. My parents were quite strict on me to, like, learn how to be independent from, like, 12, 13.
Mm.
So the dishwasher, like, washing up, doing washing, cleaning the house, like, just doing stuff that... When I, like, in cooking food as well, like, having to cook my own food a lot of the time, not all the time, but, like, twice a week at, like, year 9 onwards.
Yeah.
So, what, like, 14 onwards? And I remember, like, even when I moved out with friends at, like, 24 years old and they couldn't do certain things.
Yeah.
I didn't ridicule them, but I hope I didn't, but I was almost like, oh, what, you can't do that? Then I had to sort of take a step back and think, well...
Yeah, it's kind of like...
Not everyone was doing what you were doing at 14.
How come I know how to do that and someone else doesn't?
But then it feels easy, right? Like, it feels simple.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I don't think Sid had ever boiled an egg.
Yeah, that's mad.
When we moved in together.
That's mad, yeah.
And it's like, I mean, granted, he doesn't really like eggs. He doesn't really eat eggs.
Okay, well, that makes
it easy. But when we first met each other, I was a vegetarian. So, like, a lot of my diet was egg-based. Yeah. So, like, that seemed mad to me.
Yeah. You vegan now?
Like, I'm fleegan now.
Oh, that old one. Yeah, that's a good... At least you're doing, you know, you're doing something good.
Yeah, I don't eat any meat, but... And I try to not have any dairy or anything like that. But
that's cool.
It was hard on tour.
Yeah,
like it was really hard. That choice on tour was really hard. So we kind of had like a little band of Fleegans.
Okay,
where
that's cool.
Like if you know,
I rate that term. You know,
if we were in a restaurant and there was nothing vegetarian without cheese, then we'd eat the cheese.
Okay, that's fine.
But then yeah. Like you know, we would strive to be as vegan as possible.
Okay. Well, at least you're trying to. Yeah, that's at least you're working towards a goal.
I mean, there's no excuses really. Like if you want to be vegan, you should be vegan. But like you know, it was difficult at times to eat like a balanced meal and not
while touring.
Yeah. Like sometimes we would just be going to Spoons just to order like a side of vegetables because we couldn't find anything.
Yeah.
Like the only vegan thing on the menu is chips all the time. So like, yeah, it was tough. But
it's kind of like, so what you've basically been saying as well is like everything you've said is like linked back to the comfort zone. And I did a podcast, like my last episode on my own talking about the comfort zone. And it's so fascinating because I've only just realised more and more that like every single thing that we do in our lives links into a comfort zone. And there's some amazing videos online about it. But like, it's all about like, essentially like your comfort zone isn't necessarily physical. It's more mental than physical, but you can link it to physical locations. But like in this comfortable zone, everything feels great. And any step out of it is like really difficult. And it makes your brain almost makes you feel like it's dangerous, but it's only trying to protect you. But it doesn't really know what's good for you at this point. Your brain is just like a sort of, almost like a traffic light system for a lot of your decisions because it's based on how comfortable you are in that very moment. So for someone who doesn't like do running, that is going to seem like outside the comfort zone as like a real big challenge and like, oh, what if someone sees me run? Mm. What if I don't do it right? Oh my God, it's so embarrassing. But once you do it, you step out of the comfort zone. After like the third or fourth time running, you'd be like, oh, I actually really like this. And suddenly your zone has expanded over to running now and it gets bigger and bigger. So everything you're saying about going to the bar, even like going on tour and like going up to different places and stuff, all you've done is expand your comfort zone. But I think the thing to remind ourselves is that like the zone can decrease as well with complacence. Like if I get, is that a word, complacence?
Complacency maybe?
Maybe that's the word I'm looking for potentially. I mean, when you get complacent, it's like your zone shrinks down again and I think you feel everything's scary. You must have this before, right? You do something, you're doing all this stuff, crazy stuff in life, everything's great, you have no fear, everything's fine, and suddenly like you stop doing something, you kind of, your routine kind of shrinks a bit, suddenly everything feels scary again.
Yeah,
I think quarantine,
I think now, yeah, that's like that's like described pretty much everything. You know, I'd got to a point where I was on tour walking into strangers' houses and like living there for a week
or
2 weeks
right,
without even batting an eyelid because I knew it was going to save me money as opposed to getting somewhere on my own and stuff like that. But like now it's like that seems mad to me again.
But you've done it.
Yeah,
that's the thing to remember, don't it? Because it's like, you know, when you look back at your life, think, oh, so much better back then. Like, oh, back then I was so much better. But actually, like, that is, you're the same person. You can do exactly the same thing again. It's just retracing your steps.
Yeah.
So like, and the only step to retrace, and people, because people be like, okay, what made me so good back then? And they try and like go through this deep and like really intricate list of things that made them good back then. But the simple answer is expanding your comfort zone, taking a step out of it. Mm-hmm. That's the answer to every single thing. When I look back at myself, like I had quite a bad start of the year. Like a bit of a breakdown, like living in London, I felt quite lonely. I missed my friends here. My life in London was just like work and like eat and sleep. And I was going to shows all the time, but it was great because I was like going out of my comfort zone and doing new things around London on my own at night. But the thing is, had this breakdown and I started to like reminisce back in like when I moved out into Brighton for the first time with like two friends, and it was like this sick time. I was at uni. I felt like the best version of myself. Like, oh, I really miss myself. What was it that made me so good back then? And I spent like 3 months trying to like work out and configure what made me so good back then. And then one day, it was like a month ago, my sister came in my room and we were having a chat and she was like, I think you just got to expand your comfort zone again. And I don't think she even meant it how it sounded.
Yeah.
But it kind of triggered me and I was just like, hold on a minute. That's exactly what it was. The reason it was so good was I did everything out of my depth. Like I just did stuff, like new stuff, moved into a new flat, new area, went to a new uni, started a new job. Like everything was happening. And actually that helped me grow as a person. So what you're saying there about like how you were before on tour, you can do that again. It's just a matter of taking that step forward, which is scary, But at least you know in yourself that you can be exactly like that again, whatever you're doing.
Yeah.
You can do it. It's kind of interesting when you think about it like that, you know?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It is interesting.
That makes sense, right?
Yeah, I'm not like, it definitely does make sense. It's just like right now, it's...
Scary.
Yeah, it's scary. And it also feels so far away with everything that's going on at the moment, you know, like...
Small steps, though.
Yeah, definitely.
Know?
It just feels like I don't know when I will... if I will be going on tour again.
Sure,
do you know
okay.
what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
no, of course.
I don't know that anything could happen. And I guess that is the same every day, whether you're in the middle of a pandemic or you're not in the middle of a pandemic, anything could happen any day. But like, you know, there's nothing to stop me walking out of here right now, falling down, breaking my ankle and never dancing again.
Mm.
Like...
Ooh, scary for...
You know, like...
Yeah, it's real.
And I think my what ifs, they do range from the large to the small. And I do think about stuff like that because I do think, like, as I was saying, it's been... tomorrow exactly 6 months since I was last on stage, and like I do think sometimes I do sit there when I'm allowing myself to think about those big what ifs, I do think like, what if that it never happens for me again?
Yeah. I'm with you, I think. And also like when there's not a lot going on in your life as well, when you feel a little bit like less than average, you don't feel that great, it's very easy for you to get lost in these mindful, like, these scary, like, mind traps, do you know what I mean? And it gets worse and worse if you keep thinking about it. But also, like, as much you might not go on tour anytime soon, you can still, I guess, take steps towards feeling better in terms of feeling more comfortable with things and kind of expanding your comfort zone with or without tour, if you know what I mean. Do you know what I'm saying about that, right? It's like, because I feel like, I think it's just saying yes to stuff, I find. But I think with your work, it is like a very scary thought to be like, oh, am I going to be on tour again? But you know you will. It's just a matter of time.
Yeah.
Because really, like, it's the same for me working in music. I used to go to a lot of shows through the summer, especially like festival season. And it was always such an exciting time. And then I'm sitting here as a booking agent, like, well, there's no shows.
Yeah.
Like, my livelihood has pretty much been like, put on hold, apart from actually like releasing music. But at the same time, I know for a fact that there will be live events again. It's just a matter of when. But in the meantime, what I'll do is just try and be the best version of myself that I can be, so when it does come back, hopefully I'll be stronger and ready to embrace it even more.
Definitely.
But if it doesn't come back, at least I've done a lot of positive things to build it rather than waiting for it. And then maybe it doesn't work out, but maybe I find something else to do, something else will come along career wise or job wise. So It is fascinating, but like, do you give yourself enough like self love? Like, do you kind of like, do you beat yourself up a lot?
Yeah, I don't know. I think,
and I don't mean to sound like a rude question,
no,
but you know
no.
what I mean, right?
It's definitely like, I think in terms of my industry, that the whole self love thing is really like hit and miss, if that makes sense. Because a lot of the time, if you know, celebrate yourself, you can be seen as arrogant. You know, there's a lot of people out there that haven't had careers like I have had, and they haven't, you know, had the opportunities that I have had. There are also people out there that have had far more opportunities than I've had and have had careers that I would maybe deem as greater than mine, even though, you know, you try hard not to compare yourself. You know, like, everyone has personal goals as well. Like, I think the goalposts keep moving, but that's because I'm moving them myself, which isn't a bad thing. Like, before, the goal was to be in London doing a West End show, and that was it. I thought, once I ticked that off, I've done it.
Yeah.
Now, I think with the way like the industry's moving and stuff like that, my new goal is to be in an original cast of something. Because the way like to be part of something brand new, like, that's what excites me now. Like, to be part of something completely brand new. And so now that's the goal. That's what we're working towards, and stuff like that. And I do sometimes have days where I think you do have to look back at where you've been and how far you've come, because like, you are deserved. Like, I am deserving of sometimes sitting there and going, I am a good dancer. I am a good actress. I am a good singer.
Daily affirmations.
But I think with what I do, because I am told no a lot, like, that's hard. You know, and this is what I was thinking about on my way here. I was thinking about all these different things, and I was thinking about like, about the industry. And I think it is one of the only industries in the world where they are allowed to discriminate, because they are allowed to not give me a job because I'm too black or too white or too thin or too tall or too fat or, and that has happened, you know, like, and it's normal for us. If you know what I mean, like they can out things and they can ask for someone to come into a role and to, for it to just be people of color in for, for that role.
Okay.
They can ask for to just see white people. They can ask for those kind of things. They don't have to open it up to all ethnicities. They don't have to open it up to all body types. They don't have to open it up to all genders. Like it, and it's allowed. And when I was coming over, I was thinking about one time when I didn't get the job because I was too fat. And it, I was thinking about it and I was thinking how hard it is to self-motivate in times like that. You know, how hard it is to, and it's normal. I saw a thread on Twitter about what's your most frustrating audition or life feedback that you've ever had. And the number of women that were in that thread saying that they've been told they hadn't got the job because they were too fat or that's because of their body type and stuff like that. And these are women that I know. You know, I know these women are big women. And even if they are big women, that's not a reason, you know, but like it's so hard because big women, black women, like trans women, they deserve to be the female lead as much as the straight white women,
100%.
You know, like they are deserving in everyday life. These women are just as deserving of love. So how come on stage, they're not like just as deserving of being the love interest and those kinds of things. And like, I was thinking about it and I was thinking, what does that actually feed to me? And what has it fed to me? Like during life, like how many times have I watched something and thought that like that will never be me because of maybe representation or because of what I've been told or whatever? Like how many times have I sat there and consciously or subconsciously thought that will never be me? And how has that affected me in my life? You know, it's a lot to constantly see on stage the white woman be the one that gets the guy and the black woman be the funny friend, you know, and what has that said to me my whole life?
Well, it's a bit of a, it's just a kicking you down in the dirt really, isn't
it? Definitely.
Let's just say how it is.
Definitely. And I was thinking about it and I was thinking about how actually now I've obviously learned a lot about myself and about like the world and stuff like that. And definitely recently with the whole like Black Lives Matter movement and stuff, I'm starting to realize a lot of stuff that I've put up with that actually now I'm like, no, I don't want to put up with that anymore. So I think a lot of people, and they do it ignorantly, and also a lot of the time it's not bad natured, but like when we're talking about what roles I might play and shows and stuff like that, they say to me, oh, you'll make such a great such and such. And it's always like the black role, you know what I mean? It's always a black role. And I was sitting there and I was thinking, yeah, cool, like I probably would make a great whatever it is, and but also I'd make a fucking great lead.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%.
Like I could lead the show.
Is there anyone like pushing for change in this industry?
Yeah, there's a lot of pushes for change. There is a lot of pushes for change.
Is it like big people involved who are trying to push it as well? Or is it more people like just, you know, coming into the industry?
It's really hard, I think, with our industry because there's there's a lot of backlash about it. There's a lot of backlash about
it. Okay, so people are aware of this
people are definitely aware of
it. And let's just be honest, like it's racism. Let's not beat around the bush. Like
there's so many different types of discrimination happening in our industry.
Yeah.
And people won't call it discrimination. They'll call it your castability.
So you know, it's a horrible thing to say.
Your castability, like I have to own the fact that I am a mixed woman.
Right.
And that comes with certain things. I have to like dress a certain way. I have to appear a certain way. Like, because I have to live up to those stereotypes because the industry is still cast quite stereotypically.
Yeah.
So if I don't walk into the room looking how they imagine a black woman should look, then I'm not right for the thing that I've been put up for.
It's so bad.
Yeah.
This is so bad.
It's terrible. And it,
because TV's changed.
Yeah.
Or
it has, and it's on its way.
It's changing more than your industry.
Yeah.
Like there's definitely change taking place, but I can't understand why your particular industry is so slow and so behind and why it hasn't moved forward yet.
But it's hard because it has to, it has to some in some instances remain behind, because there are some stories that we tell that are black stories to tell, and there are some stories that we tell that are LGBT stories to tell.
Sure.
And so in those instances, we have to have the right to say we can only let a black person play this role.
Sure.
But then on the flip side, we have to make sure that the ones that can be open are open. You know, like, for example, Hairspray is... race is a heavy feature of the show.
Right.
You know, it's about black and white.
Mm.
I could never play the white roles in that show because it doesn't make sense.
Thematically,
you know, it doesn't make sense.
The theme is there. Yeah, I understand.
Like, it doesn't make sense for me to play... as much as, you know, I'd be good at it, I'd be great at it, but it also wouldn't make sense for white people to play the black roles in that show.
So the messaging in that particular show is very like it's concrete. It kind of makes sense. You understand the concept behind this particular
show.
But when there's other shows like, I don't know, stuff like Cinderella, all right, and stuff like, I don't know, like Snow White and stuff, there's no real reference to anything in terms of race.
Absolutely not.
Or ethnicity. And so stuff like that, is there shows like that which have like a sort of mixed representation now, or is it still very much like a white lead in terms of Cinderella and Snow White?
I think a lot of people have like conceptions of how a show should look, and one example that I always give is Wicked, which is the story of the witches in The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
And it's basically their backstory and how they came to be, you know, Glinda the Good and the Wicked Witch of the West. And obviously the main character, Elphaba, in that story is green.
Mm-hmm.
However, when they cast Black Glinda as the cover, so the understudy on Broadway, there was uproar.
Wow.
Because... as far as people were concerned, Glinda should be a white woman in a story where the main character is green.
It's just fucking ridiculous.
Like, and when you say it, you can't believe you have to say these things out loud.
Yeah,
you know,
it sounds unbelievable, right?
I had a personal friend of mine. Like, I was talking about the news, and I was over the moon. Like, Wicked has been going for a long time, and still in the West End, we've only ever had one black Elphaba, and the show has been going for 10 years now.
Yeah.
And like. It's ridiculous, like, that baffles me. But still, like, when I was talking about it and how excited I was about the fact that, like, there could be a black Glinda on stage, my friend, she was sat next to me and she went, no!
Wow.
What more do they want?
Wow.
And I was like, hang on, like,
is this person still a friend?
Like, what?
Yeah, that's
like, are you okay? Are you okay, hon?
What the fuck are you doing?
Like, are you okay? Do you actually know what you've just said? Mm. Like, and that's what in the industry we face like every single day, because like there are people that believe that because this space or this role has always been occupied by a white person, it should always be occupied by a white person, and that's not necessarily true.
Yeah, I agree.
Like, I have so many talented black and mixed friends that like could sing the shit out of so many shows.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely. And the opportunity is not theirs.
Yeah. It's pretty fucked up.
Because of the way people look at the world. And then, you know, there's the flip side where a lot of people will say to me that I'm fine because there are a lot of black shows out there. So that means, you know, I'll be fine because there are a lot of black shows, so I can be on stage. When I was a kid, there wasn't a lot of black shows.
Okay.
There was pretty much, it was from the top of my head, there was only really Lion King when I was a kid. And I had a conversation recently with someone about Lion King. It was myself, a black friend and a white friend. And we were sat down and we were having a conversation, and the conversation actually ended up hurting me quite a lot, to be honest with you, because he was saying, you know, it's animals, so why does it have to be played by black people?
Right.
And I was saying, because it's African animals, for one, so, you know, the population of Africa is predominantly black.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're imagining these African animals as people, you would probably imagine them as black people.
Yeah.
Also, the fact that it was one of the only shows to do what it was doing when it was doing what it was doing makes it so important to black people.
Sure.
Because I didn't sit in the audience and see myself very often.
Mm-hmm.
I sat in the audience and I saw a lot of white people on stage, and it wasn't a conscious thing. I wasn't necessarily aware of that. But the first time I saw The Lion King, I suddenly was.
Yeah, okay.
I was suddenly very aware that the people on stage looked like my dad, looked like me, okay. looked like my sister, looked like my brother, looked like my friends.
Mm.
Like, and I was very aware at that young age that I don't think I'd ever felt that before.
Mm.
So it's very, the show, and a lot of black performers that I've spoken to feel the same way about it. They feel like it had that sense of magic that they sure. hadn't felt before. And that people, you know, everyone is entitled to feel that. Everyone is entitled to sit in an audience and feel like that could be me.
Mm.
Or there was a little bit of me up there,
yeah.
you know. And it's, that's something that I've always found, like, so magical. Like,
yeah.
when I went to see Coco, the Pixar film, when it came out, about the Mexican boy and all of yeah. all the Mexican traditions, I bawled my eyes out because I thought of how much I'd have loved something like that when I was little.
Yeah.
How much I'd have loved to have seen, like, a show about a mixed family.
Mm.
Like, and for it to be as magical. And I just, like, cried because I thought, how special for all those yeah. little Mexican children to be able to watch that and see themselves.
Yeah, 100%.
And see their traditions that maybe they don't speak about at school and stuff yeah. like that because other people don't share the same traditions as they mm. do. Like, you know, like, I thought that was, like, magic, like yeah. literally magic. And that's what, like, Lion King was for me yeah, when I was a kid. So when someone who has had pretty much like the entirety of the performance industry to choose from a very young age says to me, like, but why can't I be in that?
Mm.
You know, like, I feel protective of the show. Yeah, you know, yeah, not, I feel yeah. like that's something. Like, dude, that's something that's ours.
Yeah.
Like, you've got all these shows that are yours. Like, that's something that's ours. Like, mm. you know, I don't know. Like, do I have a right to say something like that or do I not? That's, like, where sure. it sort of, it went to then. And then
yeah.
we got into a conversation about, he then said, okay, fair enough. He saw where myself and my black friend were coming from. And yeah. he said, look, I can obviously see how much it means to you. And I don't think I've ever had a conversation with someone about how much it means to them. Mm. I've just always thought, you know, it's fictional.
Yeah.
Why can't anyone be anyone? And then we started to talk about, he said, but I think that the one thing I do think is that if they're going to cast a family, they should look like a family.
Oh.
So if they're going to cast a black kid, they should cast a black parent. And I said, okay, what you're saying to me is you want there to be colorblind casting, which is basically the best person for the job gets it no matter what the color of their skin is. But then you're saying it can only go so far because mm. you're telling me that now if they cast a black adult, they then have to cast a black kid.
Yeah.
What if the white kid's the best kid for the job?
Mm.
Or they cast a white adult, they got to cast a white kid. What if the black kid's the best kid for the job?
Mm.
That doesn't work like that. And also, you're telling me that if I stand next to my white mum, we don't look like a family? Because mm. I'm telling you we do.
Yeah.
And that's real.
Yeah, for real.
Like, that's real.
Mm.
I've also got a cousin who is mixed and he is blonde-haired and blue-eyed.
Yeah.
You're telling me when he stands next to his mum, they don't yeah. look like a family?
I mean, this whole... I don't know how the fuck you've stayed so sane during these conversations, but also, like, being in this industry, having to face these challenges, like, every single day, not just in this industry, but in life, like, your mental health must... Because I've got it so easy. Like, I have it so easy. But then, like, if I was black, I'm just like, how different would my life be? With the mental health that I have already on top of it,
mm.
how the fuck would I be sane mm. and, like, being able to function day to day?
Mm.
So, like... Your mental health must have just been, like, it's been, like, abused over the years.
Yeah, definitely. And I think I'm only coming to realise it now.
So it's, like, I think, so with BLM, would you say that was, like, the sort of the point for you where you're, like, actually, fuck, all this stuff has actually happened to me, but I think for so long I've lived in this society where I've just kind of brushed under the carpet and just thought, oh, well, you know, because I know a lot of my friends who are, like, mixed and my black friends as well who have been, like, talking about certain issues and they were saying... I think when you grow up in a very sort of predominantly white society as well, you have to just learn to kind of get on with things mm-hmm. until suddenly you realise actually, I shouldn't accept this.
Yeah.
Almost the same as someone who's been in an abusive or toxic relationship for 5-6 years and then suddenly like, actually, I'm in an abusive relationship. I've just kind of got on with it thinking it's normal. Mm-hmm. And I think there's like a lot of things that come to the surface now.
Definitely. So
has it been quite like a turbulent time? Like, have you kind of taken a bigger hit recently?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I thought so. Like, it's been...
Do you panic a lot as well? Do you have like a lot of... Does it go on? Does it happen quite a lot then?
Yeah.
Would you say recent times have made it a lot harder as
well? Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Because of everything, my whole life has been turned upside down.
Yeah, for real.
You know, I've lost my job.
Yeah.
And not only that, like, I've lost my career. Yeah. Because when I came out, like, I was ready for anything.
Yeah,
you know, I was at the top of my game when I was coming up to finishing the show that I was just on. And then we had to stay home. I've not been in Brighton for a long time. So that was outside of my comfort zone.
Massively. There we go. You know, there we go.
To be there for that long, like, to be in Brighton for so long is mental to me. I'm used to being here sort of like 3 weeks and then going off again.
But you've done it. You've done it now.
Yeah, and I've done that. And then all this stuff started happening with the Black Lives Matter movement. And I started to realise... I mean, I've always been aware.
Yeah. Ever since school, you've been aware, Anne, but like looking back at our childhood together and stuff, and like we weren't super, super close, but like we were close and we spoke quite a lot. And it's, you were always very switched on, had like an awareness about the bigger picture. And I think a lot of people didn't at that time.
Yeah. And I have always been aware and I have always known right from wrong.
Mm.
And I think with race, there were so many blurred lines in my life. Like, I think it may be because my dad, I don't know if you know, but my dad's adopted. So he doesn't have any black family.
Sure.
So he was raised by a white family. Okay. So as far as like culture goes and being surrounded by black people, my dad's as far as it goes from being a kid.
Sure.
You know, I had my auntie as well who, she's my auntie by marriage, not by blood. She is black as well. But like that, it didn't go much further than me as a kid. As I've grown and I've like gained some amazing black friends and, you know, some black people that I would consider family now, you know, like I had a friend on tour who is honestly the most amazing person I've literally ever met. And he was born in Jamaica, which is where my dad's heritage is from. So, and he was teaching me stuff about Jamaica that like, my dad could never teach me because my dad never knew, you know. Like he would take me to Jamaican restaurants and stuff and I was trying Jamaican cuisine and he was teaching me how to take care of my hair and all the things that like, you know, he was able to pass this on to me. And I said to him like on the last day of tour that I started that tour with 3 brothers and I left with 4 because
he is like wow, literally wow.
And like I'm so lucky to have people like that in my life now. I have a lot of black friends who I admire and I look up to and but like as a kid I wasn't surrounded by that.
Yeah.
And
you were there was I mean, I'm just thinking back to school now.
You could probably count like the black kids in our year in one hand.
Yeah, for real.
And I was lucky to be friends with most of them. But I think that was like I don't know. I've read a lot of stuff now about how black people do band together to almost pass off the racism kind of thing. So it's kind of like if I'm there and I'm with Miles Burrell, we're going to share it between us.
Right. Okay.
As opposed to like if I'm there on my own, I'm taking it all. If he's there on his own, he's taking it all.
Okay.
You know, or like if I'm there and there's like 3, 4, 5 of us, we're sharing it between us. It's not going to be just focused on like, and I read this thing about how like subconsciously black people have been doing that for a long time.
Right.
Like been making sure that if they go to the club, they're not going to be the only black person in the group.
Safety in numbers mentality, right?
Yeah, definitely. And it's...
Which in turn is a stereotype in itself.
Yeah.
You see 5 black guys going to a club, the stereotype is so negative.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, I've been so much more like clued up to these kind of things recently because I've been realizing, you know, I don't know if you remember, but like at school, people used to call me Nignog.
No fucking way.
And that was like
people actually say
a term of, that was like a term of endearment. Wow. Like, you know, like my friends would be like
me.
To the point where someone actually asked me why I didn't get it on the back of my Levers hoodie.
Fuck off.
Yeah.
That's fucking mad.
Yeah. And I remember those things, you know, like I remember those things.
Yeah. I mean, I remember obviously being friends with Miles Knight from school who's mixed. And I mean, some of the stuff people used to say to him, I mean, maybe I was at an age where there was a bit more understand. Well, so, like some of the boys in my group, we kind of had a bit more of a deeper understanding as to like what was right and what was wrong.
Mm.
But so many people would get away with it, and teachers wouldn't even bat an eyelid.
Oh, yeah, 100%. But then
teachers wouldn't say anything.
Like, I'm guilty of it because I would laugh.
Yeah, but
do you know what I mean?
Only like, because it's a safe response.
Yeah,
it's a panic response. It's like, what do I do?
Definitely, but like I.
What if you made a scene? You'll get shunned by everyone in the school.
And I remember one time I did make a scene.
Everyone was like, "Oh, don't speak to Amber for a while."
I did make a scene because someone was taking the piss out of me because of the size of my lips.
No way.
I remember.
This is only 10 years ago as well. It's kind of fucked up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I remember standing up to them. Mm-hmm. Because I snapped. Mm-hmm. I had enough. Like, why are you taking the piss at me because I look different to you?
Yeah, 100%.
Come on.
Yeah.
Come on.
Was it in a lesson?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. It was in Mr. Avery's maths class.
Mm-hmm.
I remember it.
Okay.
And I stood up and I said my piece because I'd had enough of people passing around a picture of me drawn as a goldfish.
That's fucking
with
disgusting.
Big lips.
That's disgusting.
With like speech bubbles coming out of it. And I said something about it. And I remember I was sat next to Robbie Pope and he tried to get an applause started after I'd spoken because he felt like finally someone had said something about
fucking
it.
Yeah, so you should have.
And
done.
Then Mr. Avery was just like, right, so. And we just carried on like nothing had happened, you know, we just cracked on.
Yeah.
And
you must have felt like a piece of shit.
Yeah, like a piece of shit.
How the fuck did you cope mentally at school? How did you deal with that though?
Because you get told so much that it's just school, it's just kids, like it's just the way that people behave. You know, people used to take the piss out of the way that I walked because being black, I have a big bum.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's something I inherited from my dad. That's part of me.
Yeah.
And people used to say I walk like a duck. People used to like impersonate my walk and stuff like that. And I used to like. Not be cool with it, but I didn't know how to not
be. You just have to accept it.
I didn't know how to not be cool with that.
Yeah.
I didn't know how to say, you're taking the piss out of me because I'm different to you.
Mm.
Even though I knew it, I didn't know how to say it.
Yeah, I mean, when you think back to those times, I think what would happen was that I think there was no real way of knowing, like, When I saw it happen as well, like a couple of us used to call it out, but people were like, oh, it's just a joke. Mm. Oh, no, it's just fun. Or, oh, I didn't mean to be offensive. And then the thing is, like, because there was such a lack of people of colour in school and, like, looking back at, like, Blatch, there was, like, what? There was, like, 8 to 10 mixed kids.
Mm-hmm.
One black person, mm-hmm. two. But, I mean, looking back at school, it was just such a divide that if you did say something, you would have like 95% of that year group just kind of like, not ostracize you, but kind of just like be like, well, I'm not going to speak to her then. And I think actually you have to kind of like, you would have to like falsely and fakely adapt to just act like you're cool with it. It's
and
disgusting.
That's something
though.
My
it's
sister faced.
Up.
Like we spoke about it loads recently, but that's something she faced a lot because she is much more outspoken than I am.
Okay.
And she had that. She would say to people, like, stop doing that.
And they'll be like, you, the sort of typical response, but like, oh my God, you're so righteous. Or, oh my God, like, it's just a joke.
Yeah.
And suddenly,
you can't take a joke.
And then you're made to feel like a fucking idiot, even though, and then the thing is, but you're not. You're complete opposite. It's role reversal, really.
Yeah.
But in hindsight, then the whole school, I don't know, like, I just think it was just it's a fucking shit time for kids going to school, and it's like a predominantly white school as well.
Yeah,
like,
definitely.
Difficult.
And it's things like when you look at the statistics, like you can't deny it. You can't deny that there were judgments based on the colour of
100%. You can't deny it.
And I also think about school, and I think how many times was I taught by a teacher that looked like me?
I had no. Zero. I just had white teachers.
Yeah, I never was taught by a teacher that looked like me.
So, like, mentally, when you're going through school, because I have so many questions that I could literally talk to you for, like, 8 hours today.
Yeah, literally.
But, like, I just want to try and focus on questions that I think, like, these ones I've always wanted to ask as well. Because I spoke to Miles Knight about it, spoke to Miles Burrow about it. But, like, I just definitely in a Hove school, obviously Hove being Brighton Hove. Like, mentally, when you're, like, suffering mentally at school, like, I just... like who would you turn to? Like, I know you had friends at school, but like, how could you trust like an older white woman or an older sort of like white man in terms of like a therapist, counselor sort of relationship when really like you're explaining these issues? And but deep down, you know, deep down, it's like they don't understand how I'm feeling. They don't understand it. So mentally, like, it's almost like a survival instinct thing. Surely, like, who would you? Yeah, you could speak to your dad. You could speak to your family, of course. But like in like a sort of school environment, if you didn't have any black teachers, who the fuck do you speak to when you're having a hard time and someone's being racist to you? Because you're thinking, is this white teacher going to take me seriously? Yeah. Do you know what I mean? That must have fucking hurt mentally.
You didn't speak to anyone because also found is that there's. People are scared of the word racist, like ridiculously scared of the word racist.
Yeah, absolutely.
When actually, if you think about it, a lot of the day-to-day stuff that people do is racist. It is because it's ingrained into our society. So do you know what I mean?
I mean, you look at like institutionalized racism and it's like, it's existed. I actually always have these, I have so many debates with people about institutionalized racism and everyone's like, you know, it's a trigger for so many people. Yeah. And it's like, listen, just accept it and
just
shut the fuck up.
Exactly.
Like, just shut the fuck up and accept it. It's a fact. You can't deny it.
You can't. You can't deny it. And also, if someone is telling you that it exists, like,
listen.
Just at least listen.
Yeah.
Even if you, in the whole time in your head, you're going, I disagree.
Yeah.
At least listen.
Yeah.
Like, at least listen to what we're telling you. Because my sister and I spoke about it the other day and we said, it's actually really painful at the moment that it almost took a pandemic for people to listen to what we've been saying to them for years.
Yeah, 100%.
Like, 4 years we've been saying this stuff.
Like, honestly, like, and the thing is, every single white person is so guilty of institutionalized racism. I remember I grew up as a kid and I was like, oh my God, I'm scared of a black guy in a hood at like 9 years old because I've been ingrained in society. And that's the thing, like, people were scared to admit that there's institutionalized racism because they're scared to admit that maybe once upon a time their viewpoint was slightly warped and different. But the thing is, as much as it's a personal issue, it's an institutionalized issue, which is why you were that way.
Yeah.
I grew up and you see these things and it's like your society is almost pushing at you like, oh, by the way, like black guys are criminals.
Yeah.
Like every media outlet is pushing it down everyone and the papers and the headlines, and it's done it in such a cruel, manipulative way. And it takes a long time to kind of take a step out of the matrix
and
see the bigger picture. So when I sit there with like white guys and I'm like, yeah, everyone is subconsciously racist. I don't want to go on a tangent, but I've got to say this story.
No.
I was at the pub like a year ago and I was wearing like a hoodie, zipped up, hood up, fresh skin fade. A couple other boys, like a really big guy I'm with, like he's like 6'4", like big tattoos, like massive jacket. My other friend there, like we all looked like, you know, good jackets, good clothing outside the pub. And we were chatting about racism and institutionalized racism and they were trying to tell me it doesn't exist. And I said, well, put it this way. If the three of us are black right now, this woman walking past us right now will fucking cross the road.
Yeah.
People be like, what are those three black guys doing outside that pub in Hove right now? Like, what are they up to? Are they dealers? Are they doing this? Are they doing that? Would people judge us differently? Would people like walk past and start questioning it? Would the police get called? Like, you don't think about that shit because we're white and you don't have the bigger sense of like what is really going on.
The thing is, you don't think about it because you've never had to.
Mm.
And like, that's not like necessarily your fault, but it is something that people do need to be aware
Definitely
of.
Definitely now when it's being spoken about so much, you need to take a second
to
just reflect. And just be honest with yourself and think, have I been guilty of this?
Yeah.
So I think that's the first step for a lot of people to kind of realise what needs to change.
Yeah.
You have to understand that maybe, because people are like, yeah, but I've never been racist. I'm just, look, there's times when that institutional racism exists in culture and it's ingrained, but we're now trying to break the mould. If you've been involved in that in the past, in a sense of like basing life on stereotypes and such, it's good just to understand that and realize what you can do now to make changes and eradicate those stereotypes and eradicate that way of thinking.
Yeah.
So I kind of, it's a...
Yeah, definitely.
You know.
I'm really big at the moment on like, the challenge has to start, you have to start challenging yourself.
Yeah,
you have to start challenging the way you speak.
Yeah.
You have to start challenging the way you think because you've been taught to think. My big brother said it to me. He said, imagine you live your life and then one day someone says to you, you know the way you breathe? You do it wrong. You've been doing it wrong your whole life.
Right.
26 years, the way you breathe, it's not right. It's not how you should do it. Got to do it like this now. Like that, every single time you go to take a breath,
you're conscious of it.
You have to remind yourself that you have to now breathe like this.
Yeah.
And that's what it is. You have to now remind yourself that you can't, you shouldn't think like that anymore.
Yeah.
You have to remind yourself,
really good way of putting it,
that it's not okay to look at a black person and assume they're guilty, but to look at a white person and assume they're innocent, regardless of the crime.
Yeah.
Like, you have to understand that, like, my baby brother, being one of the sweetest kids in the world, is 11 times more likely to be stopped by the police in Sussex than his white counterpart.
Mm.
Like, that's real, that's facts, that's true. And we have to start now, like, learning to say no to this, like, to literally say no to this shit.
Yeah, it's also like calling out people, like the amount of people I've had to call out. And when I say call out, I don't mean like shouting at people, but more like if I'm in an environment and I hear something being said, which I think is blatantly racist, just not even in a jokey way, as in my approach wouldn't even be like, oh, laughing it off. It's like, yeah, you can't say that. That's really bad that you just said that. You know, really, that's not the way if you think about what you're saying. And then, unfortunately, still, 8 out of 10 times, it's the whole, mate, I'm just joking.
Yeah, yeah.
Mate, I'm just messing around.
Yeah, definitely. And that is what it is. And it's like I say, it's because people are scared of the word racist. People are scared of being branded as a racist. Yeah. You know, I'm not racist. I'm not racist. No, I don't think bad things about black people and stuff like that. You do.
With that said as well, like, so in sort of recent months as well, obviously with everything going on, and so were your panic attacks getting worse? And when was your like first panic attack? Was it like, was it school or was it a bit like recent years? We had a brief chat about this before.
Yeah, I think if I actually think about it, my first panic attacks started when I was probably about 7 years old.
Okay, so that's very young.
And I didn't, at that age, I didn't understand what I was going through and what it was that was happening to me. But I basically used to lash out quite a lot as a kid, which, like, knowing me, you wouldn't ever, like, it was very out of character what I was doing. I was being severely bullied at school by my best friend.
Was this, hate to say it, was this race-related bullying?
I don't believe it was race-related bullying. I think it was jealousy. It was driven by jealousy. So my best friend went through something quite traumatic as a kid, and she had to have an operation. Basically, her bones had basically developed not in the same way as everyone else's had.
Okay.
And she found that she had, rather than a ball and socket in her hip, her ball had like ground itself flat.
Ooh.
So she was like in a lot of pain and stuff. And as a kid, like, that's like mad.
Sure.
We were dancing together and stuff like that. So I think it was jealousy because she had to go through this and be in a full body cast. And then when she came back to school, I had to push her around in a wheelchair.
Mm-hmm.
And it went on for a very long time. You know, her recovery went on for a very long time. I don't know her anymore. I don't know if she still suffers or anything like that. But it was a lot for her to go through at such a young age. And I think she started taking it out on me because I was still able to do all the things that she couldn't now. Mm-hmm. I was still able to go to dance. I was still able to do, I was able to walk.
Yeah.
And that was something at that moment in time she wasn't able to do. I think that's where it came from. And it was like relentless, but I didn't know what was happening because it was my best friend. So
yeah, and also you're young.
Yeah,
you're young as fuck.
Yeah,
how are you meant to understand what's going on?
And so like I was having this constant like negativity like drilled into me from this girl like every single day.
It grounds
day.
You down.
Yeah,
it just, it,
and
you know.
Like I remember one time like my dad asked me to pass the salt. We were having a takeaway and we were all sat on the floor and it was like all the different dishes were in front of us and he asked me to pass the salt to him and I don't know why but I just lost it. Like I just flipped out and I was in angry tears and like I don't know why I was doing it. I don't know what about him asking me to pass the salt triggered that in me, but like it got to a point where it'd been so built up that I just lost it.
Yeah.
And I remember something similar happening on a school trip. I was trying to pack my bag because it was the last day and the girl in the bed next to me kept pushing the top of my bag back down.
Mm-hmm.
She was laughing. It was a joke. Do you know what I mean? And I was opening it and she was pushing it back down again and she was just laughing and I just lost it. to the point where one of the other girls in the room was so scared by what she'd seen that she came home and told her mum.
Fuck.
And her mum went into the school and we had to basically all be called in to talk about, like, my outburst, basically. And I was such a calm, quiet child.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I was... It was beyond out of character for me to be doing these kind of things. And when I look back now, I think it's my panic, you know, like, I don't know.
So do you ever have therapy or counselling?
No.
Okay. Is that something you wanted to do ever?
It was something that I really wanted to do, probably a few years ago now, but I was so scared of being told that I was sick that I couldn't do it.
I think people, I've been there. It's that fear of understanding the truth.
Yeah.
And it's easy to brush stuff under the carpet. And I'm not a therapist or a counsellor, so whatever I say,
yeah.
You know, don't take it with it, you know. But it's interesting because I think if you were to have a therapist, and I actually strongly believe every single human being should have a therapist, 100%. It shouldn't be seen as like... I met someone on... what day are we? Friday. On Wednesday out, and we were chatting, and this girl literally said it exactly how I say it, and she was just like, yeah, I just think every single person, definitely like in the world, or, you know, at least the UK, should be having there should be like therapy or counseling available for them for free. It should be a compulsory thing to do, whether it's school or later in life. It should just be through your life, because everything you're saying, definitely with like those early outbursts of panic, when you sit down with a therapist, you start to like link every piece together, and everything will link right up to what you were talking about at the start of the show about your fear of like going to the bar and going into certain places. It honestly would become like a chain reaction. And I think it would be interesting for you one day to like really sit down with someone and analyze where that chain started.
Yeah, definitely.
And where it goes and how you can kind of like eradicate it moving forward into like in a positive way. But I just, sorry to interject.
No, I find it really interesting. Fine. Like, and I do agree. Like, I think a lot of stuff in my life, I've sort of come away from it and thought, maybe if I was dealing with my emotions differently and if I was talking to someone about it, I wouldn't have behaved like that, or I wouldn't have done that, or I wouldn't have put myself in that situation, or I wouldn't have panicked. Like, but I mean, you know, hindsight is a funny thing because we can never know for sure. But like, if someone had recognized those things in me,
how different would life have been?
Yeah. If someone
back then it's like she's just having a she's young.
Yeah. Like if someone if maybe like my mum or my dad had gone like she's freaking out.
Yeah.
Like she's not a naughty kid.
There's probably something
like,
going on.
What's happening? Like she's freaking out.
I do think that's changing though.
Oh
for
yeah.
Parents. Like if people like me and you, if we were parents and we saw something in our children, we would understand straight away that there's more to the story. So I think we're lucky how far we've come since our childhoods, but in like a 20 year period, the understanding has grown so much in this particular mental health field. So because I had the same thing where I was having really vivid nightmares which came with panic attacks, or vice versa, and it was so dark, nasty, and I went to like a child psychiatrist, and they were like, oh, he's got night terrors, like, just is he watching scary films? That wasn't what was going on.
No.
I was just, there was other stuff happening in my life, but this child psychiatrist couldn't even identify it back then. Yeah. It was just like, oh, he's just got this.
Yeah.
And I think like that must have been for you as well, being at school. And I thought to myself, imagine how different my life would have been if I'd sat down with someone at a young age and they explained to me what a panic attack was, what was going on in my body in a childlike way.
Yeah, definitely.
Not how we explain it now at this age, but I think my life would have been a lot easier. And I think a lot of these things, with children experiencing shit at school in those development years, we would be preventing so much. I don't know, just we would prevent so many like bad incidents that would take place in children's lives just from a younger age being able to identify certain things. So yeah, I think it's just interesting because I think every single guest out on the show is all developed under 10 years old.
Yeah.
And that's what's so sad about it.
It is so sad because I don't know what would have happened if someone had noticed that stuff in me as a kid. If someone had noticed when I was younger that I had like such a huge fear of dying that for a long time I didn't go to sleep.
Was that your fear?
Yeah.
So he won't mind me saying this, but Sam Moss from Blatch, had the same thing all the way through secondary school. And I used to laugh it off. I was like, mate, just don't worry.
Yeah.
Dicker. Do you know what I mean? What a dicker response. But I was young. I didn't understand what to do. But that is such a viable fear. And I bet if you ever said that out loud under the age of 16, people would just be like, oh my God, just don't worry. Yeah, what are you worried about?
People thought it was ridiculous.
Even like teachers and like role models in your life. Yeah, yeah. Even parents might have been. Yeah. And then suddenly, that's like me though. Your role models are like people that you look up to and they're almost dismissing it, which makes it even worse.
Yeah.
And it's no hate towards anyone else. But
I think that's something that has continued throughout my life. Like, it's always been sort of a case of you've got nothing to worry about. So why are you worrying?
I hate that so much.
You know, like, and that's something that I wanted to touch on today because my industry is late in terms of a lot of stuff.
Yeah, we've established that today.
You know, it's late. Yeah. I think the world is late, but my industry is later.
Yeah, your industry is like 100 years behind.
You know, it's essentially like Stone Age stuff that's happening.
Yeah.
And throughout my life, like, these people who were teaching me and training me were, like you say, my role models, the people I was looking up to. And if I was ever brave enough to go to them with something, I was always met with the same narrative.
Yeah.
The same narrative. Yeah. So I remember when I was training at college and I went through this really horrible stage of having no faith in my own voice.
Okay.
Where, like, every time I went to sing, I just thought it sounded horrible.
Okay.
And I was on the verge of tears, like, every time I went to
sing. Deep-rooted insecurity coming through,
Like, it was massive. And, when I think about it now, I know where it came from.
That's good. That's a good sign.
Because they were, you know, trying to train me to sing in a different way to how I'd always sung my whole life. And, you know, I was hearing things that, like, my voice had no colour. My voice had no tone. My voice was harsh. My voice was... And I hate to say it, but I don't know if maybe I'd had a couple of black teachers if that criticism would have been the same, because I have a black voice. So I don't know. Most likely you can't hear yourself.
I think what you're saying is valid and makes perfect sense.
I had a conversation with the same teacher that I'm talking about now quite recently, actually, and that was an interesting enough conversation, because I essentially basically brought that up and said, like, do you think that I would have had that crisis in confidence if I'd been surrounded by black teachers who had said to people, she's meant to sound like that.
Yeah.
That's what black people sound like.
Yeah.
Or maybe not even that. Maybe there's nothing wrong with her sounding like that, because the shows that she's right for and the things that she'll go on to sing and the things that she'll go on to do sound like that.
Yeah, 100%.
And coming, like, being taught by predominantly white teachers, I don't think that thought ever crossed their mind. I basically went to my teacher and I shared the fact that every single time I opened my mouth to sing, I felt like crying, because I felt like I was producing this awful sound.
But it was the complete opposite.
And
it's ingrained in you to believe that it was an awful sound because they're trying to make you sound white.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
And
like, that's the honest truth though, isn't it, really? Like, that's what's going on here, which is quite nasty.
Yeah, and it was like, you know, he said to me that basically what I was feeling was ridiculous. And
there you go. See, it's back to the ridicule. It's like, you're the idiot.
Yeah.
You're just an idiot.
And he told me a story about how one day something awful would happen to a family member of his. I mean, he went into more detail, but it's obviously his story to tell, not mine. But how something awful would happen to a family member of his, and he found out about it just before he was due to go on stage, and he still went on stage and did the show. And if he could go on stage and do a show when he was in that state of crisis,
making you sound stupid.
I can stand up in front of the class and sing a song.
Wow.
And it also, another situation happened like that with another teacher.
That's got to be a generational thing, surely. Like, there's an age gap here, right? There must be.
It's not massive, though, the age
gap. Wow, no way.
It's not massive.
I always notice on older white men who will say stuff like that. Back in my day.
I think it's an industry thing.
Right, okay.
Because I think what we're
taught...
It's so behind.
Fuck me.
We're taught, like... We're pretty much taught, physically and mentally, you can't really be ill.
Yeah.
That's like detrimental to your career to have a day off.
Yeah.
And we're pretty much taught like the show must go on.
Yeah,
no
I mean,
what's wrong with you?
This is where our industries cross over, but there's been recent change. Obviously, stuff like Avicii, where you know this brought a lot of light on the industry, and unfortunately, it normally takes until something really, really shocking and devastating to like change an entire industry.
Yeah.
Because now, since that incident, obviously you were aware of that story with Avicii. So, since that incident, like so many management companies and booking agents and promoters have to kind of band together now and like really be careful with their artists and what they're demanding and what they're expecting. Obviously not now because nothing's happening, but when shows were on. So it took something really shocking to make change. But everything you just said there applied to my industry 100%. The show must go on. Mm-hmm. We used to do, I mean, fucking hell, a couple of years ago, one of the artists that I managed, like we did like five shows in a row. And it's like, you're going from here to there, you're sleeping. There's alcohol in the room. Mm-hmm. There's drugs everywhere. Like you walk into a show, you've got like cocaine, you've got alcohol, you've got everything. And you're eating food, you're eating out, and like you're not sleeping, you're waking up, getting out of the hotel, you're playing a set 4 till 5, then you're having to be out the room by 10 because it's obviously you've got to check out, and then you're on a train or you're driving, and it's burnout season. It's so fucked up. Yeah. And so I can really see those similarities with what you're saying, your industry, and what happened to mine. But unfortunately, or fortunately, there hasn't been anything, I guess, on a large scale, like devastation, which will start to really cause a shockwave and make valid, sorry to move the table, make valid change. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
No,
it's really
definitely.
Horrible.
No, I know exactly what you mean, but I think that's like, it's not.
It's a ticking time bomb.
Yeah,
really.
It is a ticking time bomb. And I think that there are people who I've met as part of my career that, like you say, like it's a generational thing, but then I think about some of my friends that would encourage me to go on stage.
Yeah.
When I'm not well physically or mentally, you know, because if I don't go on stage, then there's no one to do my job, if you know what I mean. So, you know,
the pressure's
huge. And it's, and it, as I say, it's across the board, physical and mental.
Yeah.
So like it would be the same thing if I was to go to them and say I'd hurt my ankle. They would tell me a story about how they broke their ankle, but they
still broke my leg and I was on fucking stage, so you better do it yourself.
My leg fell off and I still did the show. Do you know what I mean?
It's the
same thing. Across the board, it's the same thing. So you go and you tell someone, this has happened to me.
Yeah.
And they say, yeah, but this happened to me and I still did it.
Do you know what? On topic but off topic, that is probably the fucking worst thing I've ever heard from anyone. When someone makes you feel like an irrelevant piece of shit based on their experience... Mm-hmm. These people, it normally comes from broken people, I swear. Because, you know, when it's like, oh, but back in my day, like, I did it.
Yeah.
I had to do that. I had to do worse than you.
Yeah.
It's this constant comparison. It's constant, like, well, I could do it then, so you can do it now. When really, like, everyone's got their own unique circumstances anyway. You can't base your experience on someone else's or vice versa. So the fact it's, like, ingrained in, to be fair, both our industries, it's still ingrained.
Yeah.
Some people that I like work with, I used to have to go to shows all the time, and I had people, and I complained once to someone that I worked with. This is not now, this is like back in the day. And I was like, well, they made me go, so like, I was going to shows all the time, and it was late, I was working all day and going to shows all night, and then I was really struggling. And I had this show once, like the artist I wanted to see was on 2 till 3, and it was like a Wednesday night, and then had a meeting at 10 the next day, and my boss was like, look, I could do it. You can easy, you, as a human, you can actually really function for like 3-4 hours. Sleep. It's probably actually better for you. And I was like, you're literally chatting shit out your ass. You're chatting shit out your ass. You just made that up on the spot. And also, like, I don't know, if I was running a team, which I do run teams. I've had people that work for me who were like, I'm really burnt out this week. And I said, take some time off.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want you to be burnt out. That's not the aim of this. Like, you're my boy or you're my girl. Like, I need you to, I need you to be good. I work for you. But the point is, sorry, a bit of a tangent, but I just, that really triggers me when anyone says like, oh, I could do this straight away. I'm like,
yeah,
but it's different though.
It is.
Even
different.
My dad would be like, oh, you know, back in my day, I was doing this. I was like, dad, that was 53 years ago.
Yeah.
So just, that doesn't make any sense. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Sorry. Tangent.
No, but it's definitely true. And I think like there are moments in your life where you like will never ever forget them. And one of those was when my granddad died 5 years ago. I was talking to Beth about it, and Beth obviously tragically lost her mum when we were young. And I said to her, like, I'm so sorry for coming to you about this. Mm. And she said to me, what the fuck are you talking about?
Mm.
This is the biggest loss you've ever felt in your life.
Mm.
Why is it any different to mine?
Sure, yeah.
She said, don't be stupid. You can always come to me about anything. Yeah. And it was so refreshing to have the opposite of what you normally get in those situations.
And what's fascinating as well is that, oh, I have to wrap up soon, I'm sorry, but what's really fascinating about that is that can apply to so many different things on a mental length as well, because, like, people are so afraid to talk about how they're feeling because they're worried that someone's been through it worse.
Yeah.
So whether it's loss, whether it's depression, anxiety, panic attacks, anything in life, we're always conscious that someone else is worse off than us. So instead we shun away and we hide away from being open, because it's like, I'm going to be honest, like, that's what you said to me when I first started Instagramming you about this like a month ago.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, but it's not that deep. And I'm like, well, but it's you. Everything's unique and individual. So what you're experiencing might feel like the end of the fucking world to you. It might feel the worst of the worst, almost like you've got like an actual illness, like you've got cancer.
Mm.
It might feel that extreme.
Mm.
But doesn't mean that my experience is any less or any worse than yours.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really good point you mentioned about Beth, because that is a really important thing to remember. And it's really refreshing to hear that as well.
Yeah.
Like, I just think people need to understand that everyone's got their own unique experiences, and what may affect someone may not affect someone else, and vice versa. And the list goes on. But I think it is good that you are able to have those conversations with people. And the fact you were able to go to her is like a huge thing as well.
It's massive. Like, and it was not what I expected at all. And I, like, I really remember it. You know, that conversation was over 5 years ago now. And I remember it.
That's like, lovely to him. Well, look, you know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Yeah. It's like out of a really tragic time for both of us came like that thing that I really hold on to. And I just wish that those kind of conversations were happening everywhere that I went.
Yeah.
You know, I wish that when I was going through pain at work, someone would say, like you say to your team, have a day off.
But at the same time, I completely agree. Because I still don't hear enough of that in the industry, but I guess it's up to people like us to make that change.
Yeah, definitely.
It never really happened until I started doing it in my job now.
Yeah.
Because we were being burnt out, and I was the one who was like, hey, like, I can just sort that. Don't worry. Like, this is meant to be fun.
Yeah.
This ain't meant to be like, I don't want you to die from it. So maybe, like, if someone that you know in that industry is going through it, you can say, hey, like, we're not saving. Because you're not. The best advice I ever got was from one of my old music jobs, right? My first, like, graduate job. I went to go work in London. It was a massive change. I went from, like, living in Brighton to, like, commuting to East London and being around all these fucking huge music artists and people. And I was like, fuck, it's overwhelming. And then I had a real difficult time adjusting mentally to it. It was really, like, difficult. There was so much to do. And I had a lot of imposter syndrome, and it's all shit. But anyway, my boss came up to me and was like, let's go for a walk. I was like, all right.
Mm.
Went to the canal in East London. We're like in Haggerston in East London.
Mm-hmm.
And we sat on this wall and she was like, listen, just one thing that you need to remember. And this is like the ethos of the company. We're not saving lives.
Mm.
And I'd never heard anyone in music ever say it before. This company was very pro mental health. But just the way she was, my boss, who's like setting me work, was like, we're not saving lives. Like, whatever happens, it's really not that deep.
Yeah.
Like, it's okay. Same for like your industry, like you're not out here like on the front lines, like, do you know what I mean?
But yeah, definitely.
People just really need to understand, like, people high up in these industries need to really start to make their changes, because it's going to fucking hit them hard if they don't start doing it now.
Yeah, definitely.
The industry will be in uproar sooner rather than later. It'll be really bad.
Yeah, it will, especially with all these things that we see going on now with like people on big sports teams refusing to play and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's all happening now.
It's happening, and
it's good. It's good that it's finally happening.
It won't be long till it trickles down, you know. And it's awful, but it's also necessary.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
In some situations, like there's points when I've had panic attacks side of stage and still gone on and done the number.
Such a horrible thing to think about.
Because like, there's a snap second where you have to make the decision.
No one's going to give a fuck if you're panicking. Someone's looking at
you, and they're going, are you going on stage or not?
Stop fucking panicking. Yeah. Get a fuck on stage.
Are you going on stage or not?
Yeah.
Sort your makeup out, go on stage.
Yeah.
Like, because there's 30 seconds to decide whether I'm going to be there or I'm not.
These people in your industry remind me of like old toxic mates I used to have in my life who I don't have anymore, and I'm glad that I don't. All I can picture is them in my head being like, oh my God, stop worrying, get the fuck over it and get on with it. I can just picture like 2010 friendship. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, that's like what your industry sounds like. It's like 10 years behind.
It is ridiculously, 10 years, 10, 20 years behind. Ridiculously behind. You know, like one of my friends had a mental breakdown whilst we were on tour. I wasn't friends with him at the time. I was lucky enough to meet him again later on, but and he had to leave the job. He was playing a keyboard for us and he had to leave midweek. And like the comments that were made.
Oh, I bet the reaction was like fucking disgusting, right?
It was awful. Like, and knowing this person now, you know, and knowing what they went through and what caused that mental breakdown, I just think like if they could have been a fly in the wall, like in that room when, you know, people were talking about it and stuff, like it comes from these people that don't understand. Like they don't understand what being close to a mental breakdown could ever feel like.
There's so many similarities between like mental health and like BLM stuff at the moment in terms of like, it's awareness, understanding, and like acceptance as well. There's like not a lot of that going on in both sides of the coin right now. And it's up to us to make these small steps and these small changes to affect to create the ripples in a pond, really. But it's hopefully we can make these changes, but it's going to take a lot longer and it's going to take a lot of people to actually start to really get that momentum to do so. But it's just what you said there, like people just don't understand, they don't get it. And that's like people who are just like not trying to, who don't want to get behind like the BLM stuff and just getting behind what needs to change and what needs to sort of adjust in our society. People are just like ignorant to the fact that there's a problem. And that's like people with mental health. It's like, but back in my day, like we didn't worry about stuff. It's just you kids, you just worry. Like, and I think really like it is pretty toxic. But like, I have to say, I need to wrap this up really soon. And I could talk to you for like 8 more hours.
Yeah, literally. But There's so much more stuff I could say. I know,
literally, like, I want to go on for, like, hours, but you can come back on another show.
Yeah. Well, I'm not doing anything.
Exactly.
There's no theatres for me to be in.
We can do a part two.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that?
Yeah.
See,
well, there's still loads.
But, like, before we finish up, because I would like to do longer, but we'll see. Restrictions are restrictions. Mm-hmm. With your current mental state, because we kind of touched upon it at the start.
Yeah.
But, like, how are you feeling now?
I think,
like, honestly,
I think if I'm completely honest, I go so up and down, but mostly I am in a state of like mental turmoil, like most of the time.
Okay.
Because my entire life is upside down. And at the moment it's dealing with the fact that a lot of other people's has almost gone back to normal.
Okay.
Like a lot of people have got their We're the last to be back on the map.
Yeah.
Like a lot of my friends, the only difference now is they have to remember their mask when they go to the shop. You know, they've got work, they've got the pub, they've got restaurants, everything like that is back. Whereas like for me, like what I enjoy my job and we are both very lucky to be in a situation where we enjoy our job. And so it's not just our career, it's our passion, it's our hobby, it's everything to us.
Yeah.
So to not have it is like huge.
Yeah.
And like to not know when it's coming back as well is also
that uncertainty
huge.
Is like horrible. Yeah.
You know, I think I read this thing about a crisis, a state of mind where basically you can cope with it if you know what the end is, regardless of what that is. So basically, if you know someone's dying, you know the death is the end.
Yeah.
And your brain can cope with that because they know once the death comes, that's the end.
And they can plan for the steps after.
Yeah. But with this, like, we're in a state of mental crisis, but there's no end.
Mm.
We don't know what the end is. Like, you know, people keep on being like, oh, the end's a vaccine. But is it a vaccine?
No, we don't know.
Do you get a vaccine and suddenly all the theatres and music venues reopen?
No.
Probably not.
No.
Like, you know, the end is social distancing.
Yeah.
Well, they're saying social distancing could go on for 2 years.
Yeah.
Does that mean, like, we're looking at a thing where I've not been on stage for 2.5 years?
Yeah.
Like, you know, that's...
And you start thinking about it and you get that hot feeling. Like, oh.
And because I've got nothing to do, like, I'm thinking about it a lot. Yeah. And a lot of people ask me, all the time, like as you do, you know, like, oh, so what's going on then? So, where, you know, I've seen that theatres are opening, so you're going back on stage soon.
Yeah.
And it's like, no. Like, I've always had trouble explaining my industry anyway, because it's alien to a lot of people, especially in Brighton. Like, I think really, other than my friends that are in Brighton that I know because of performing, like all my school friends and that, like, entered different fields entirely to what I did. So, you know, and even like my mum and dad explaining it to them, like they always think if you've got an audition, you've essentially got the job and all of those kinds of things. Explaining it, breaking that all down has always been tough, but this has been like next level.
Yeah, I bet, yeah.
Explaining that just because they've got the go-ahead for the theatres to open doesn't necessarily mean that I'm back on stage.
Yeah, likewise with the shows that I've got in, and, you know, it doesn't mean that one of my artists is going to get booked for one of these shows. Yeah. And, you know, that's a story in itself.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, that's half the struggle. And then, you know, you've got to then be prepared for when the industry does open its doors again, that I am not necessarily going to get acceptance straight away.
What's your sort of, like, short-term plan in the meantime? Like, are you going to look for another job at the moment to sort of tie you over? And is there anything that interests you outside of what you have been doing career-wise? Is there anything that's related to your career that you would quite enjoy doing?
I don't really know, okay. Like, to be honest. And that is
that's okay.
Just, like, the best answer that I can give at the moment when people ask that is I don't know. For me, it's so hard because getting another job feels like giving up. It feels like giving up my career, and it's all I've ever known since I was so young. It's all I've ever known how to do. Yeah. Like, I can apply myself to other things, and I believe I can apply myself quite successfully.
Yeah.
But I'm not meant to be doing those things. You know, I'm meant to be doing this. This is what I'm meant to do. And I have got, like, a couple of things coming up. Sort of September time, a little bit of dance teaching here.
That's
and
really
there.
Cool. That's so soon, like, as well. September's really soon.
Yeah, so I'm pleased about that. And
that's nice.
You know, it's just, it's bittersweet though, because it's like, I'm committing to that. Because
this, but also,
exactly. So, like, it's just that, and that just plays on my mind. Like, I'm obviously buzzing to be, like, getting back into a dance studio and to be teaching. I love teaching. I've done it on and off for like 6-7 years now. And, like, I enjoy it. I get a lot out of it, and I love being creative and getting to, like, create choreography for the kids and stuff like that. Like, I'm excited about it, but it still, like, you know, doesn't spark that flame in me like performing does. And so, like, I'm worried about getting a 9-to-5, but then I'm also worried about
money
and like what everyone worries about. Like,
I mean, it's so shit, because I know so many people in my industry are faced with the same dilemmas. A lot of people were. But I've said to people, thing is, you know what you want. And it's a lot of the time, maybe this doesn't apply to you, but a lot of the time, it's how we're perceived by others, which affects our decisions. So if I was like, let's say I lose my job, right? Because also I've got all my side stuff, but I've got a full-time job, quite a reputable, like, music company. It's great, you know. I'm on a part-time salary at the moment since there's no shows. But the thing is, I think a part of me was like, if I lost my job and I had to go work somewhere else, it's the perception people have of me. Like, oh my God, what people think of me? I've done so well and I'm just working here. Like, what's happened? But actually, like, it's my story. And to be fair, this is just like, it's a temporary gap if I was to do that, for example.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of the time we're scared to do stuff. I don't know if this applies to you, but a lot of my friends are scared to do stuff based on what people think of them. And I think it's nothing to be ashamed of. Like, it's a normal thing to think about. But I think for you in your situation, like, you're definitely going to be back on stage. It's just a matter of when.
Yeah.
But to bide your time and fill that gap, it's tough to work out what to fill it with. Yeah, so I understand definitely. That. If there was, like, a dance-related role that you could do, like, like, properly, like, you know, could be good. But
yeah, would definitely. And then that would obviously be something that I would be, like, definitely, like, looking at doing and excited to be doing. You know, I know you know that I was working in Tesco at the beginning of lockdown, and, like, when people who knew me walked in, like,
you were like, oh great,
so, like,
embarrassed.
It was gutting, because it did feel like taking a step back. And that's not to, like discredit anyone that works in Tesco, because I think people that work a Tesco career, like, some of the shit I had to put up with was
fucking I worked in Tesco. I know it. I know how it is. Yeah.
And, like, I've done retail before, and I know, like, the struggles and all of that kind of thing. And if that's what you choose as your career, then, like, it's just as worthy as my choice of my career. But then at the same time, what I would always say to people is, like, the people that I was standing side by side with at Tesco, if I took them to my job for a day, they'd feel the same way.
Yeah.
They'd feel like, oh, well, I'd rather just be at Tesco doing what I know.
Sure, okay, interesting.
Like, I'd rather just, like, I don't feel comfortable on stage. Yeah. I don't enjoy dancing. I don't, you know. So, like, they wouldn't want to do that.
No.
Like, and it's not a case of, like, I wasn't grateful for it and I wasn't thankful for it and I didn't appreciate everything that the other people in the store were doing and that they wanted to do that as their thing. But, like, it wasn't mine.
Yeah, no, I'm so with you, and I was there when I was working at Tesco, when I was running the label as well. And it was weird because I was already, and this is not to blow my own trumpet, but I was already doing like some really cool stuff in music, and I was like going on tour, so making loads of money on music, but I was still at Tesco just to like buy my time and like keep my routine up while I was at uni. But I remember when I saw people in there and they were just like, oh, didn't know you were to Tesco, and it's like, oh, well, you know, I do still.
Yeah.
But I used to get really embarrassed, and after a while I was like, mate, like, fucking embarrassed, like, I'm making money from here, but I'm also, it's a test of our character to be able to work a job like that and also be building a career on the side.
Yeah.
And actually, like, if you were to go work somewhere that's different to what you're doing as a career, it's only temporary.
Yeah.
And actually, I don't think it's the end. Because really, like, I know it feels that way mentally, but it's not, because as soon as someone's like, oh, by the way, why don't you come back and do this? You'll be like, okay, how many nights in by? And you'll go do it. Like,
yeah.
And you haven't got advertised on social media. It's a social media thing as well. You haven't got advertised and be like, yeah, I'm going to go work at so-and-so now for like 5 months temporarily while I wait for my industry to come back on. Like, you don't have to. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I understand where the insecurities come from with that. And I know so many people in music who are now working jobs like that they don't want to be doing. But some of them take on the chin. Some of them are just like, yeah, well, you know, it's temporary and it's just I'm making some money.
Yeah.
I've got friends who are like big time music video producers and stuff and doing really cool stuff. And then I saw one of them doing delivery.
Yeah.
And then he looked at me as if to be like, oh, this is embarrassing. And I was like, mate, this is well cool. You're just chilling doing delivery. That's waiting for the industry to come back.
Yeah.
That's smart. Like, well done. You're not just sitting your ass waiting. And you're still doing film stuff.
Yeah.
That's great. So I think it's just, I don't know, societal, what's the word? Societal, just like how we interpret things. It's all a bit backwards, but
yeah,
I understand.
Definitely.
Sorry to ramble. It's just,
no,
it's
no,
a really interesting
it's
point.
Fine. I mean, it was a bit of an industry joke at the beginning of lockdown that they hired so many West End people in the Sydenham Sainsbury's that it was like a who's who, but like
funny.
People were walking in and had probably seen these people on stage because they're in the heart of the West End and not even realizing that, you know, they're in there and they're being served by the people that are working in Hamilton and Wicked and all these things. And
mad.
These people are side by side on a checkout now because that's what we've got to do as self-employed people.
Yeah.
It's what we've got to do.
Yeah, for real. I think things will get better though, but like, I really appreciate you coming on today as well. And I know it's a hard time, but we'll chat outside of this show anyway, and then we'll get you back on down the line and then we'll have a chat. It'd be nice to kind of like recap things with you in like a month or two,
like
if you're up for
bookend it kind of thing,
because
like,
it'd be nice to see how things develop, definitely with your stuff in September. It was like the end of September or like start of October, you can come back on and we can kind of talk about how you've been from here till then, so from there, you know what I mean. So it'd be quite nice to sort of see that journey, if you don't mind.
No, not at all.
If you felt up for that.
Yeah, definitely. And hopefully we can be sitting here having a conversation about how far forward things have moved.
I hope so, in all senses of the
word. Yeah, literally, in terms of everything.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. I'm going to end it here. But thanks for listening and thanks for coming on, Amber. And I'll speak to you soon.